Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting, at least for us, episode of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And of course, the reason it's exciting for us is we have the next 2 hours, we have the opportunity to really screw things up.
All we have to do is lose what we're going to say.
Huh? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. That's all we have to do.
Or worse, say something that we didn't really mean to say, and you go, Anyway, the telephone numbers to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And the personal wealth coach and messieurs, is that what you actually say it? Messrs. McClure and McClure here are also advising principals at an SEC-registered investment advisory firm that happens to have the same name as the radio show, and we've been trying to figure that out for years, but I don't know.
I don't know either. It's so coincidental. I don't know how that wound up.
Yeah, I think it's just.
It's like the same coincidence. You've got my last name. I've got your last name.
I haven't figured that one out yet either. It's all very, very weird. 1 + 1 = 7. Anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. And caller, you are on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Thank you. There's a large pharmaceutical company out there that's going to spin off their pet medicine business, and I was wondering how something like that would affect the present stockholders.
Well,
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Right. First thing you have to know is it takes a very strange type of person to keep medicine as a pet. So from the beginning, that's
medicine.
Yeah, much worse than a chia pet.
No, we've got
medicine as a pet.
Yeah, but we have pets that are medicine.
Well, I suppose it'd keep our heart rates down or blood pressure down.
Yeah, it works pretty well.
But having pet medicine.
Now, but spinning them.
Yes, we are being a little bit silly.
A little bit? Ha!
A lot of bit. We're being a lot of bit silly.
Yeah, that too. Well, what happens is when one company, quote, spins off one of its subordinate companies, there's several different ways that can happen. Can be sold. Often when it's sold, there's just cash, which comes as a special dividend. It also, there can be a sale for stock, in other words, sold to someone else. And you may get, for example, you had 100 shares of one company, and the next thing you know, you've got 2 shares of some other company because a division of it was sold. And of course, if it
has to do with what they're telling their shareholders they're going to do with the money. And Pfizer has a lot of research that it's planning on using this money for. So it's the same kind of question as why you want to buy the stock to begin with. It's the same question you would ask now. Well, now they're much more refined. They are a core business, and it's easier actually to do research on this company now than it was before because you didn't have to take into account whether or not they have something wrong in their animal health unit.
Right.
Yes.
Makes
so
very good sense, I suppose. Yeah. So, telephone numbers to call in here again, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And let's see, did anything interesting happen during the week?
Let's see. Yes, there are a couple of things. Since the last time we were on the air, some minor events have happened. Somebody went and inaugurated or something like that.
If there's an inauguration, shouldn't there be an out one?
I think they should have an out inauguration as well as an inauguration. I don't know why they don't.
The market apparently got involved. The stock market got involved in a party as a result.
What kind of party was that?
A really happy one because the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 13,895.98. Isn't that exciting?
Sounds like so.
That means it's like almost 14,000.
One of the things that I find, you were just mentioning this, and I totally agree.
Well, I'm glad now that
yes,
you don't have to say what it is.
We just agree. And we don't need to talk about it anymore. We're just agreeing about things.
We both agree that the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 13,895.98.
Right. That's not what I was agreeing on, but I agree with that as well.
Good. It's nice to know we're in agreement.
As the bumper music was playing, the thing, a little headline appeared at the bottom of the TV as it's scrolling across the news station, and it says Dow Jones Industrial Average down 4% from all-time high. That's the kind of headline I like to see about the market, because it's emphasizing the downside. As soon as people start saying it's only this much to go in the headline.
You're talking about the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Right, right. Here's another one. This is from, as I like to pronounce them, Reuters, although everybody else tends to think they are Reuters. Bears hibernate as stocks near record highs. Okay, but then it goes on to say the bearish case is a difficult one to make right now. But those are lines that I love to see.
You like to see the bear's butt?
Yes. The reason why we like to see that is because as soon as everyone agrees we're in a bull market and that all we have to look forward to is bull in the future, that's the death of the bull market. As long as everybody's saying, yeah, maybe we're in a bull market, but that only, and then they have a big butt at the end of it, but that really, or fill in the blank, everybody has this pessimism, this fear about what's going on, that means that the bull could still remain healthy for quite a long time. This is, it's just the psychology of investing. And to those of you that haven't listened for years and years, we can explain that again. If everyone thinks that the market is going to go down, then they probably already sold, which means it's less likely to go down, because if everybody is already sold, then it's as low as it's likely to get. That's what makes the market go down, is when
right.
people sell. And if everybody thinks the market is going to go up, if all the news anchors say, at this rate, my portfolio is going to be worth millions of dollars, or fill in the blank again, that means that they've already bought, which means that if everyone has already bought.
Bought. Wasn't that what you were spending?
Yes, the bot in Thailand.
Okay.
I have spent bots in Thailand. I have bought with bots in Thailand. You but if everyone has already purchased into the market, then that's the only thing that makes the market go up is purchases in the market. And if a large majority of people have already purchased, then it's not likely to go up a whole lot more in the future. So right now we have the opposite of that going on. People are just beginning to realize that, hey, maybe the market is actually going up, but hey, things could be bad. And so this whole aura of pessimism still exists, and that makes us very happy.
One of the interesting things about the way the market has risen, the stock market, the United States stock market specifically, has risen, is that, you know, it's up in January so far this year up 5.4%, and that is it's pretty impressive. As goes January, generally speaking, so goes the year.
So you're expecting that the rest of the country is going to be cold all year round?
No, as goes January in the stock market.
Oh, okay. I was
just talking about the stock market.
Strange. No. Okay.
Well, I actually think that probably this time next year, the country will be
might
cold
have
again.
A cold spot.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to be able to make a prediction on that?
Yeah, I think next January will be colder than July.
I'm predicting a warm June in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah. I think I'll go with that. That's good. Anyway, this rally, if that's what they like to call it, a rally, has been incremental, been no sudden rush upward. It's been steady. I like those. It has been on high volume. The other thing that's going on is, generally speaking, the price of bonds this year have been falling. The price of gold has been falling this year. This is very orderly, and it's one of those things that finally something's going on that makes a great deal of sense, and that is people are moving out of bonds, out of gold, into stocks. Now, of course, the big question is, why are they doing that? I think the answer is that there were a lot of things people were afraid of, even the professionals were afraid of. Many of the professionals were forecasting big trouble ahead about now.
Fiscal cliff.
Right.
Dangers.
They basically have concluded that the crises that we have been looking at are of our own making, and that the people who are proclaiming the crises are generally not willing to follow through or capable of following through and devastating the economy. And once that starts to occur, then people began to trust that things will be better as time goes forward. Not that they wouldn't have been anyway. It's an interesting thing to me. As we ended last year with the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index up nice double digits, for example, the one-year return right now on the S&P 500 with the dividends daily reinvested is almost 16%. But you just don't hear people talking about that. People are still suggesting the market is down. Well, I like that. That makes me very happy. But the reality is that ain't so. It is done very well. Matter of fact, to give you some idea.
Even if we talk about the Dow, people talk about, well, the Dow is not back to its all-time high.
No.
Well, it is actually.
If you reinvest the dividends.
if you reinvested the dividends, it's way up above where its all-time high is.
But psychologically, it's not.
Right.
What's interesting to me is if you think about it, if you a year ago or during the year would have said, okay, where is the place I sure don't want to be invested? If I'm in stocks, and people said, well, I sure don't want to be invested in Europe. Well, why did they not want to be invested in Europe? Interestingly enough, the European region, the stocks in the European region, in other words, companies based in mainstream Europe, one-year return, 20.52%. Wow. And therein is one of the issues in the market. The thing that we're worried about the most almost never is the thing that bites us. It's whatever's going to bite us next.
Unless it's a really angry pit bull. And then sometimes if we're worried about it, it still bites us.
We really don't spend long periods of time worrying about angry pit bulls. At least I don't.
No, you're correct. I generally don't. And when we talk about the market, we're not talking about pit bulls either. Because as you have emphasized over the years since I've known you, and I'm, again, in complete agreement here, when we create the environment where we produce the risks as well as we produce the solution to the risks, for instance, in a political situation, if everybody is afraid of one thing, that's the thing that winds up not happening politically. It's when everybody says, oh, that's not going to happen, that it tends to happen because it takes our collective will to make it not happen. And the same is true in the market. If we all think that there's a market dip coming, then it's not likely to happen because we all collectively are working against it without even realizing it.
I believe that to be true. For whatever it's worth, we use an algorithm. I love that term. Al Gore invented those.
Yes, Al Gore's rhythm.
Actually, it's a formula that was written by a guy named Harry Markowitz back in 1952. And at least in our experience, and also the experience of everyone else who I've ever read.
And the Nobel Prize Committee.
It has been the most consistently predictive method of investing a portfolio. So we tend to use that. Anyway, for the last year, dear old Harry Markowitz's formula has been advising us that we probably ought to be reducing our bond holdings. And we ought to be investing domestically in mid-cap value as an asset class. So here we are, about a year after it began singing that tune rather dramatically. And it's interesting to note that the, let's see if I get this here, year-to-date, long-term bonds are down 0.25%. They, across the board, bonds have been dropping this year, which is basically what he told us to get out of. And the according to the Wall Street Journal, mid-cap value mutual funds as a group are up, 6.92% so far this year, which puts them ahead of the S&P 500. And last year, I saw lots of articles that said that large-cap stocks were the place to be, and large-cap growth stocks were coming back, and that's where everybody ought to be. And you have to really go down the list to find how well that particular asset class has grown. Not that they've done all that poorly, but it's really fascinating to me that we look over the long term, We make our predictions over the long term. We then can look back, and so far, pretty much without exception, those long-term predictions have worked out very, very well. And at the same time, whenever we say, this is the place you ought to be, and this other place is the place you ought not to be, we inevitably get some people who say, well, I don't,
right.
Why do you...
This is a good point. We actually had some questions this last week from listeners and clients saying, we've been down-talking bonds, we've been down-talking gold.
Down-talking, that's a new term, I like that.
Talking down to them and putting it down.
Yeah.
Why? Because, and they say, well, it's still up. You know, for instance, specifically municipal bonds. This is my kind of pet topic. I think municipal bonds are probably the most dangerous area of the bond market besides the high yield bonds right now. If you look at the difference between most of the municipal bond interest rates and the interest rates of non-municipals, there's not a whole lot of difference in the interest rates. The concept of behind municipal bonds is that they don't pay, you don't have to pay federal income tax on the interest that you earn through a municipal bond. And that's supposed to mean for the municipal bonds that they can offer a lower interest rate and get their money cheaper so that they can do things like road projects and school projects and all the things that municipalities do. But when their interest rates are getting so close together because everything is really low right now.
That's called convergence, by the way.
We, as a political group, by the people, say, well, why is it that they have this benefit when it's not really a benefit, even though at other points in history it's been a massive benefit? And at the same time that we're talking about this, municipalities all over the country are failing. So interest rates should be a lot higher than they are on these municipalities. There's just this implied, well, maybe the insurance companies will step in, maybe the state governments will step in, maybe the federal governments will step in. There's all these ifs. So that's a danger that exists. And right in the middle of that, over the next 3 months, Congress is going to be putting some very, very open-handed things on the table for tax reform. Both parties are very interested in tax reform. And one of the issues that has been brought up again and again, and I haven't seen it hitting the media in big waves, which means that it's being held very close to the vest, is municipal bonds interest being tax deductible. You don't have to pay, not deductible, you don't have to pay taxes on the interest of municipal bonds when you buy them. Well, both parties are looking at that and saying, we need to bring in more revenue. The Republicans don't necessarily like that concept. That's raising taxes. But this isn't really a raise in taxes if you're taking away an exemption. That's the way they're looking at it. The Democrats are saying, well, who is it that uses municipal bonds anyway? It's those rich people. I see that as being a very clear danger to the municipal bond market. The bond market as a whole is already in danger.
Is it a clear and present danger?
I'm not sure how present it is. I think it's a future danger. It's a clear and future danger.
If it's a clear and present danger, then the president can take it out.
Possibly.
You know,
that statement doesn't really necessarily conform with a presidential thing. It has to do with freedom of speech.
Oh.
When the Supreme Court said that if you yell fire in a crowded theater,
it better be a clear and present danger.
Correct.
Right, okay. Well, you know, I have a little different approach to the same thing. I agree with everything that Jake just said, but...
Wow, we're doing... This is... We need to have this program recorded. We don't ever do this.
We are
agreeing with everything.
It is actually being recorded.
I just need to disagree with you
with
something.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be recorded.
I disagree. Okay. There, I'm disagreeing. Now, this is much better. Go ahead.
There's a couple of things about bonds in general that make me a little bit on the nervous side. And very simply, if we take, for instance, Vanguard runs an index on municipal bonds that we track because the data is easy to find and it's very, I think, very robust, and I like it. And besides that, I like it. Anyway,
you like it and you like it is what you're saying.
You got it.
Okay.
The weighted price in their index right now for the municipal bonds in those index is about 112. Now, what does that mean?
That's a good question.
That means that when these bonds, you're paying in the portfolio, when you buy the bonds in this mutual fund, in their mutual fund or in their index, you're on average paying about $112 for every $100 of maturity value. So the next thing you want to take a look at is how long until they mature. And the answer is about, average about 6.4 years. So let's just round this off. You're paying $112 for a bond that's only going to yield $100 when it matures, and it's going to mature in about 6 years.
12% loss over a six-year period. No, what's the interest that it's going to be paying during this time period?
There's a couple of interesting things there. I'm trying to see this thing here and talk in the radio at the same time, and my eyes are not as good as they once were, so I'll just make it bigger.
I figured the further away you are from the screen, the better it is. You always pull those papers about 8 yards away from you.
Yeah, but
them.
I put my glasses on, too. Okay. The annual income is $3.68.
Okay.
Now, so what happens is you have bonds that are for every $112 you give them, they're paying you $3.68 a year. Now, this is at least one of the fascinating things about it. The yield to maturity on that particular portfolio is about 2%. Now, I want to emphasize what that means. If you buy those bonds today and you get the full coupon rate on the bonds, which looks pretty impressive, you're getting, in essence, a return of your principal, which in many cases is going to be subject to alternative minimum tax, if the alternative minimum tax isn't completely, if you happen to make a lot of money. But here's the key.
I'm just going to use the math that you just gave just to give some numbers. Okay, so it's a 112. It's maturing at 100 in 6 years.
Right.
In 6 years' time, if you're talking about $3.68 a year,
right,
that's $22.08 that you get back in taxable income.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not taxable.
We're talking about municipals? Okay.
Yeah.
So $22.08, but of that, $12 is actual principal.
Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't have been taxable anyway.
Right.
Shouldn't be, but it would have been.
It would have been in a normal bond. So what you're actually getting is $10 out of this,
mm-hmm.
not $22.
Over a six-year period.
Over a six-year period. You get 10 full dollars out of 100. So over a six-year period, without compounding, with very, very simple interest, if somebody says, I'm going to give you $10 if you give me a loan of $100, in 6 years, I'll give you $110. That's not a very good deal.
What the key is, and this is where I look at a bond fund, the yield to maturity on those bonds, that portfolio of bonds, before we get involved with the fact that mutual funds have expenses and there's all kinds of things that get involved here, your yield to maturity is 2%. Now, very frankly, why plug in inflation into this thing, I have no question over the next 6 years that inflation will run around 2%, maybe a little higher. So if your yield to maturity on the average bond in this nationwide index is 2% a year, inflation runs anything higher than 2% a year, what that means is in 6 years you will have less buying power than you invested. And here it gets better. If interest rates go up just a little bit, you will see the resale value of your portfolio rather abruptly drop
by
about 11%. Well, let me give you an example. So far this year, some of the more widely traded ETFs that claim to be indexing on municipal bonds have typically dropped around 2% already.
Yeah. And when we look at this, I mentioned this already, but you get that interest rate risk that you have already in all bonds. Then you take the reason why these bonds are supposed to be better than other bonds, and you put that in question, which is what's going on right now in D.C. Washington, D.C., they're talking about municipal bonds. They're talking about mortgage interest deductions, and if you look at the things that have just been passed, some of the mortgage interest deduction has gone away at upper levels. Just imagine if they do that to municipal bonds. Who, again, who has municipal bonds in their portfolio? It's generally people that are looking at their taxes and saying, I need to get a little bit of a tax break and get some income in the process. So it's generally people that are in an upper tax bracket. If you're in an upper tax bracket, you've got a big crosshair on you for these tax deductions and tax breaks that you're getting. And municipal bonds are at the front of the list, or the top of the list, the front of the line, waiting to get the axe put to, and I don't think they're going to say to somebody that has $30,000 a year of income, you don't get your tax break. But I do think they're going to say to somebody that's got millions of dollars, we're going to phase out that tax break for you because you're rich.
Anyway, this to give you an example of some other areas.
And that will have an impact on the market. Yeah, go ahead.
When we talk about bonds, long-term government bonds, weighted price about 127. Intermediate government bonds about 111, 112. So when you have bonds that are widely priced above their market value, they're not market, above their maturity value, and you recognize that there are going to be expenses along the way that effectively raise that price, you're in risky territory. And, of course, that is where people have been for the last couple of years pumping their money heavily. The public has been selling from equity mutual funds and buying into bond funds. Now, does that mean you shouldn't have any bonds in your portfolio? No, I
absolutely
don't agree with that.
Not the same thing at all. I think bonds are crucial to have in almost every portfolio.
Mm-hmm. And there is a right kind of bond, and there is a right way to have it in there. But generally speaking, at this moment in time, our goal, at least in the bond portion of a portfolio, has nothing to do with expecting a return. It has everything to do with providing liquidity, which means that we have tended to move to very short maturities.
Short duration,
which is a little complicated. But the key is to have AAA ratings. And I also like, and we're kind of focused on that, government backing. And so what we've done is basically we're not trying to make any money on the bond side, on the interest rate side of the portfolio, and we're very happy to be over in the appreciation part of the market to make any gains that we have, and we use the bonds as cushioning. Unfortunately, a lot of people have been chasing bonds for their yield. And if you have enough yield in a bond right now that it is significant to you, in other words, you have a fairly high coupon on the bond, fairly high interest rate on the bond, then I can tell you without hesitation, you are at significant risk for loss of capital, for loss of principal. And that's just, unfortunately, any time that you're in a bond where the interest rate on the bond is significantly higher than the interest rate on treasuries, and the interest rate on treasuries is a little below 2%, then you are in a position where you're taking a lot of risk in your bonds. And the higher the interest rate,
The higher the risk,
and people just can't seem to get that through their head. They chase that interest rate wherever they can find it.
All right. Now, the final thing here real quick before we do some commercials is gold. This is
the final thing.
Well, the final thing
gold.
Before commercials is gold. Gold is an interesting item. We have gold in many of our portfolios. It's not something that we say is a wonderful thing. We generally look at gold and we say, unless you're creating something with it, there's no reason you should make a profit on it. Doesn't mean people don't make profit on it. It means that it's gambling when you do. It's supply and demand, pure and simple, and the demand for it is relatively limited. And the demand is just like in most, the vast majority of the demand for gold is the same kind of demand you have for a sports card or a comic book. It's rarity. It's I get to show people that I have this, or I get to say that I have it. Gold in itself, unless you're doing electronics with it or you're creating jewelry, there's a lot of minor things that you do with gold. I said minor. Did you see the pun there?
Yes.
A miner, gold miner. Anyway, you shouldn't expect to make a profit on it. A lot of what we do in the gold area is we have companies that are mining gold, that are actively trying to make a profit in getting the gold out of the ground. That's actually creating utility.
Those are called gold diggers.
Gold diggers. You got to watch out for them gold diggers.
Right.
So recognizing that there's areas of a market that are overpriced, gold has been holding up relatively well. But the reason why it's been holding up relatively well is because there's been a bit of a boom in China and in India. Well, that boom doesn't look like it's sustaining very well in China, and India might have some trouble too, in which case gold will be coming back onto the market. And if they have any kind of a major downturn in China and India, we have the reverse of our expectations for gold. In the past, in the United States, when we have a massive downturn, people turn to gold. Gold prices go up.
Except in 2009.
In 2009.
In 2008 and 2009, when the market went down,
so did gold. The reason is because people in India and in China, historically, over many, many, many decades, centuries, millennia, have used gold as their savings vehicle. And because they have gotten much more wealthy, they can buy a lot more gold. Well, what that means is that when times are tough in India and China, they sell their gold so that they can buy food and so that they can, it's their savings, which means we have this weird blip, unless you understand why it happened, of market goes down, gold goes down with it. What? Well, if market goes down, it means there's less demand to buy from India and China in the United States. So the Indians and the Chinese start selling their gold, which causes gold prices to drop.
And the other, there's a very key element in gold, other than the fundamentals. I tend to focus on the fundamentals, and the fundamentals of gold are that the reason people buy it is because of some kind of an emotion. There is no intrinsic. The intrinsic value and the actual value of gold.
Very different.
And that's a little scary. So you
like
don't know when
it's going
to reverse.
It's very much like a baseball card.
But if you were going to buy gold, you can't just go out and buy a gold bar and take it home with you and expect to be able to sell it. If the price of gold, let's say, goes up $100, you go out and sell it and get $100 more than you paid for it.
You won't. There's a transaction cost.
Well, there's not only a transaction cost, but the bar of gold, once you take it into your possession, has to be reassayed to make sure that you didn't cheat somehow.
You didn't pull it.
So,
that's where the word deface comes from,
so
by the way.
If
you deface,
right.
You've taken the face off of a coin because it was made of gold and you maybe shaved it a little bit. Anyway.
Well, so you'd probably buy something like a Cougar Rand or a U.S. Gold Eagle. The markup on a purchase or sale, typically, on gold coins like that, if you find a very, very low-cost dealer and you're a good customer and you do a pretty high volume, is about $100 per coin. And those coins are one-ounce coins. So, basically, if gold moves, gold has to move up.
$1,600 right now.
Yeah, if gold has to move up $100 before you break even, that's a hard thing to get around. The other thing, of course, is if you handle that coin, the value goes down.
Because it's not just the gold value.
It has to be uncirculated, because otherwise, every time you handle the coin, some gold comes off on your fingers.
And all you have to do to figure out what your gold is worth on the open market is follow one of those spinning signs on a street corner. We buy gold. Take it in there and see how little you'll get for it.
Yeah, and it really comes down to an issue that gold, if you're going to buy gold and you're going to hold it, you have got to encase it in something. You've got to protect it. You either have to take it home and somehow insure it, which is going to cost you some extra, or you got to put it in a safety deposit box, which costs something. So the longer you hold gold, the more it costs you.
And then you've got the reverse of that. If you hold a paper form of it, a certificate that says that you have gold somewhere, well, first off, there have been a lot of scams in that area.
Right.
Because it's not a security. And by that, we mean a stock. It's not a bond. It isn't something that the Securities and Exchange Commission regulates. You have to go to, what is the new commission that's been appointed for commercial regulatory whatever the Obama administration created it to police
consumer
this sort
protection.
Of there we go, consumer protection, and they're the ones that have to go and say, wait a minute, you've sold 3 certificates for 1 ounce of gold, but it's the same ounce of gold.
Well,
and that's happened.
Hopefully they will go check these guys out, but in fact, if you get a certificate, it needs to be from a very reputable place, and you can tell it's a reputable place because they will charge you by the month to store your gold for you.
So once again, you have an expense associated with holding the gold. So when we look at gold, we say there are some major expenses. There is no real reason why it should retain the value that it has.
Well, to give you an example, if you held a theoretical, hypothetical, which you can't, share in the Standard Poor's 500 stock index, they would pay you about 2% a year to hold it.
Instead of you paying about 2% a year for holding of gold.
And you could be, let's say you bought a share in a gold, not a gold, but in a S&P 500 mutual fund, and you have a certificate for the share. But by the way, that costs something too.
Right.
But still, if you buy stock, which over the long term, by the way, rises in price better than gold over a long period of time, they'll pay you to own a diversified portfolio of stock. They actually pay dividends to you. In gold, you pay dividends to them. So there's a lot of reasons that gold doesn't appeal to us. But commercials do.
Yes. We keep the radio program running.
So we have to break for commercials, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure, and we have some important, I guess they're important, but they're at least words from KTEM's sponsors, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And no, I did not know.
We didn't know that we had packed commercials for gold and silver.
No, and we do not obviously have anything to do with those commercials, and we certainly don't support them. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
You need to turn that other dial that you don't have your that
one
right
there. Yeah, okay. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
Good morning, Jeff. Jake.
Well, good morning,
good
Flying
morning
Fox.
To you. That's not Flying Fox.
It is. Isn't it Flying Fox?
What I'm calling about is shortly before you guys came on today, I was watching Fox.
You see, he was watching Fox. That's what got me.
They were talking about some kind of new charge of 4%. Regarding credit cards, do you guys know anything about it? I haven't heard anything about that.
I haven't heard anything about
a new charge of 4%.
That's what it appears. I use credit cards all the time. I never carry any cash to speak of.
Do you know if this is a merchant surcharge or what is it that you're?
Well, I tuned it in late. I happened to turn it on late and. So I really didn't know, but the way they were talking, it was something.
The only new.
Oh, okay, I know what's going on. This goes back to the same law that created the consumer protection. Basically, what it is, it's a lever or a methodology that merchants can use. I'm remembering this now. It's foggy memory. I slept since then. Merchants can tack on a charge now. To something if you use a credit card. Before, MasterCard and Visa and American Express and Discover all said that if you charge somebody with our cards more because they're using the cards, we're going to cancel your ability to use our cards. And what that did is it meant that merchants were losing or were not making as much money when you use a credit card because they get charged between 1 and, unless they're really in a strange situation, between 1 and about 2.5% for using a credit card.
Right.
If they do really, 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 really high volume, then it can be down well below the 1% range. So, for instance, Walmart doesn't pay 4% or 3% or 2% or even 1% when you use a credit card, but your local diner does.
Okay.
What this law does is it says that because there are extra expenses involved, the merchant is allowed to tack on up to a 4% charge when you use the credit card.
They generally do that backwards, though.
Right. They generally say
a discount for cash.
We're going to give you a discount for cash. But what this is it says we're going to charge you more if you use a credit card. Now, it's very unlikely that this will actually happen because the merchants get most of their income through credit cards at this point. If you go to a typical restaurant, their cash is very, very, maybe 10 to 15% of their income comes from cash. The rest of it is credit cards. And if they start charging you extra for that, then they get into trouble. What they've really already done across the board is raise their prices by about 3% on everything because they recognize that the people that are paying cash are so few. So that exists, and that I'm thinking it must have been sometime early in January or in January.
Because I've already seen a couple of places where, for instance, gasoline, you can actually get a discount for paying cash, which before was illegal.
Okay, yeah, here it is. It's popping up here. January 27th is the date that their retailers will be allowed to tack a surcharge of 4%. But as is normal in news reporting, if you tell everyone that they're going to have to pay 4% for using a credit card instead of the reality of the merchant is allowed to tack it on there if they're willing to try to scare away their credit card business. There are going to be some people that do it. It'll happen. But I think the vast majority of people have already accounted for it. It's going to be the very small businesses that do this, and they're going to be the ones that generally are not giving you toothpicks because it costs too much at the restaurant. So I wouldn't be too afraid of this.
Okay, well, I appreciate your clarifying that for me. I was just kind of, now that you've brought it up and explained it, I remember.
It's kind of like the 3.84% charge that the emails were going around. That when you sell your house, you're going to be charged 3.84% by the abandoned. No. First, you have to make over $250,000 a year to pay that extra. Secondly, and that's adjusted gross income. Secondly, you also have to make over $500,000 on the sale of your house. So I don't think, if you make $1 million profit on the sale of your house, you're going to pay some taxes on that one, baby.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot to...
That would really hurt.
Yeah, it would. That 3.84% on half of $1 million profit on a house. Nah, I don't sell it because doggone high taxes.
Right.
Well, we gotta go, though. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks for the call.
Okay.
And we are the Personal Wealth Coach, whether we like it or not.
Yes.
And
let me wrap that up just real quick. Same kind of vein of thought. I was just reading about how in New York some people in their townhouses are experiencing a very difficult thing in that they've got five stories and they rarely see three of those stories. They generally spend most of their time on just a few stories of their building, and they're complaining about how there's artwork that they haven't seen in months. And while I generally am sympathetic for a lot of things, I'm just not one of the things that I have a whole lot of sympathy for. And we're almost out of time. We've got a call coming in. If you can make it really, really fast, caller.
You're on the air with the Personal
Coach. Yes, I listen to your program almost every Saturday, and I really enjoy it. Today has been a really educational, informative program. It's really been good.
Well, we messed that one up, didn't we?
I've never heard you make any comments about your theme music. I like bagpipe music, especially Amazing Grace. Can you give us some background on your theme music?
Sure.
Absolutely.
But it'll probably be next hour before we do. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We are an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. And we manage port. If you have enough money, basically, that you're ready to live on it for the rest of your life, you probably need somebody like us to manage it.
Yes.
And you can reach us locally. We have a voicemail on weekends, and obviously they were there during the week at 947-1111.
Or toll-free, you can reach us at 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts there So if you're not quite insane after listening to 2 hours, you can go back and listen to many, many dozens of hours.
So you throw pods from there?
UPod, iPod.
Podcast.
We can cast it.
A podcast is sort of an interesting thing. I don't know what... Nobody has an iPod anymore. Anyway.
We have iPhones. But
anyway, we are, like I said earlier, in the investment business, but we're going to be breaking for news. We'll be back on the other side of news with another hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. So hang in there and listen to the good news from Fox.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.